Morning, y'all. My name's Wayne Conrad, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date's December 14th, 1980. And if I live to Christmas, it'll be 35 years. I thought that'd be quite impressive, but hell, I come here. I think 50 years is the youngest one here, it seems like. My wife has 40. She's not particularly impressed with it, I know. I was born in Texas, moved to Louisiana as a young child, and raised in a Southern Baptist family, which is a breeding ground for a lot of us alcoholics. I never heard my daddy use a curse word. I never saw him take a drink. As far as I know, he never did. One thing he said was kind of prophetic. Before he died, we were talking one day, and he said, he said, the reason I never drank is because I was afraid I might like it too much. And at the time, I was in the throes of drinking, and I didn't put it together. But since, I recognized what he was talking about. Like someone else said, I think this disease is somewhat hereditary. I don't blame anybody for it. I had the option of doing it or not doing it. I took my first drink as a young teenager. Might have been 12 or 13. I don't know. Piping Rock Slow Gin. Only a drunk would remember the brand of his first drink, 13 years old. Nothing particularly happened. An uncle who is nearly my age and I shared a little bit and did that just for funsies. I don't know what point my drinking got serious. I do know that in high school, I was not a particularly good athlete. I didn't know how to dance and didn't fit in a lot of places. But I found out I could drink most people under the table. And that became my claim to fame. Most of the guys in school called me Wino. And every chance I got, I drank. And I didn't always get drunk. Didn't always have enough money. But there were times where we got lunch money to go to school. I don't remember what it was, 50 cents a day or something like that. I'm not sure. But I would miss lunch and save my money so Friday I could go buy something to drink. In the summertime, a couple of summers, I worked in the hay fields. Paid $3 a day. And I'd get paid on Friday, and by Sunday I was broke again. We'd go out and drink it. So I never missed an opportunity. At about 19, I married my high school sweetheart. She was 16. We began a family quite rapidly and moved off to Houston, Texas, where, of course, my drinking was about the same. I drank mostly on weekends and a few beers at night. It wasn't that bad. I was 19 or 20 years old when we moved, and Texas, the drinking age was 21. But I've always looked a little older than I was. So with a short time, I had a charge account at the liquor store. And I've always been a whiskey drinker. I drank a little beer when it was necessary, but the day I sobered up, I preferred whiskey. You know, a good 100 proof bourbon's hard to beat. I'd switch off once in a while to scotch, because some of my friends drank scotch, and it was handy, and it's not too bad. I drank at every opportunity, and it got to the point where made the remark one time. I got up in the morning and fixed myself a drink one Sunday morning, and she made the comment, you know, if you drink in the morning, you might be an alcoholic. And I got a little unhappy at that, and she never said it again. But it wasn't unusual to get up. I don't know about around here, but in Texas, one of their drinks is beer and tomato juice. And so I kept a carton of those little tomato juice cans and poured it in a glass and drank a little beer with it. I graduated after a while to scotch in my coffee. I'd get up and pour a cup of coffee and put a pretty good snort of scotch in there. It was the only way I could make it to work. I drank to the point where my hands trembled so badly that I couldn't sit at the lunch table with the guys I worked with. I couldn't get a fork to my mouth without spilling the food. The only way I could stop the trembling was to take a drink. And this went on for quite a few years. At one time, I have migraine headaches occasionally, and I went to a neurologist in Houston, supposedly one of the good ones. They ran a bunch of tests and stuff, and he asked me how much I drank. The way he put it, he said, when you drink, do you feel like you have to finish the bottle? And I said, no, not really, which is not true. But they ran a test called the Minnesota Multiphasic, which is a psychological test he did. And his remark when they got the results of it, he said, as screwed up as you are, you ought to be having headaches. But they gave me some antidepressant tranquilizer pills, Etrafon 225s. I'll never forget them. They're good for hangovers. I learned not to mix those with alcohol at the same time. If I took one of those and drank the way I drank, it kind of screwed up my drinking. I had an unusual drinking pattern. Not too many people have related to it. A couple of people have. I heard one fellow call it maintenance drinking. Now, I wasn't a pass-out drinker. I could drink a fifth of whiskey in the course of an afternoon and function. You wouldn't know I was drinking. I could stay drunk for days on end and not pass out. I timed my drinking. If I was at a party or something, every so often I'd go in, I drank everything straight. I'd pour me a shot of whiskey, I'd get a little water to chase it down, and that's the way I drank. If I'd go to somebody's house, they'd set a bottle of whiskey and a little glass out there for me. Internally, I measured, where I wanted to be. The big book talks about, that feeling we chase the rest of our lives. And I could find a pretty level place that I wanted to be and maintain that. I'd go till I was exhausted, in pure exhaustion. And nobody could keep up with me. That's a hell of a thing to be proud of. But that's the way I drank till I sobered up. I got a divorce. I don't remember what year it was. It's not particularly important. We had four daughters, and I got a divorce. It wasn't directly because of my drinking. Indirectly, it was because I was an asshole. But she didn't leave me saying that. That shouldn't say that. She didn't say anything about my drinking until later. I ran across her somewhere, and she said, if you keep going, you're going to drink yourself to death. And that was the only comment she ever made about it, and I didn't, at the time, I didn't really care or believe it. This went on for quite a while. My pattern, I stayed single, and I finally got to a point where Wino Joe said it best. He said, if you ever took a drink against your own will, you might have trouble with alcohol. And I got to the point where if I didn't want to drink, I couldn't not drink. I would quite often say, well, I'm not going to drink today. And I would talk myself into it eventually. I knew before I read the book, I knew that if I took a drink, I was going to keep on drinking. It was foregone. I was going to go to bed drunk and get up about half drunk and feel bad. Every once in a while, I'd go on a 2 or 3 day sabbatical to try to get my nervous system in shape where I could go back to drink again because, I was shaking so bad and so screwed up. And you get tired of hangovers after a while. And although I didn't have bad hangovers like some people do, mostly it was just the shaking and wanting to drink. But this went on, and I tried several times to stop. I bought some of the self-help books. Dr. Wayne Dwyer, who died here recently, had one called Your Erroneous Zones. I bought that, and unfortunately, it didn't do a thing for me. The problem was, kind of like if I faced when I got here, it required that you do something. The information that I got in there was really good. I can't complain about it, but all I do is read it, and I'm an avid reader. But I tried my friends. I wasn't a barroom drinker. I was a social drinker. We had several friends and families, and we'd get together and eat and drink and whatever. One of my friends one day came to me and said, he brought me an AA pamphlet. And he was a drinking buddy, but he didn't have an alcohol problem. When it got to be a problem with him, he quit and got involved with the church. But he gave me that pamphlet, and of course I wasn't offended. I just took it home and threw it away. You know, my story involves, I call it angels. I don't know if anybody believes in angels or not, but I do. I've heard a bunch of people say that God speaks through other people to them, and that's been my experience. I don't know that I've ever heard God, you know, whisper anything or any thunder or anything. So I call it the angels in my life. There are quite a few of them, and I'll probably tell you about some of them today, the things that convinced me that there's something bigger than me running this outfit. Sometime later, after that incident, this lady friend of mine over, she lived in another town, hadn't seen her and talked to her in quite a while. She called sometime at night, I don't know, whatever, and we chatted, and she said, Wayne, I'm worried about you. I said, why? She said, you're drinking too much. You're going to kill yourself. And I said, well, I've been trying to do something about it. I just can't seem to kick it. And she said, have you ever thought about going to AA? And I said, no, it never crossed my mind, really. Yeah. I tried everything else. Like the big book says, of course, I drank a little wine. We'd go to parties, and my friends would watch to make sure I wasn't drinking too much. So I drank wine, but I smoked a pipe. And there's some neat stuff that you can put in a pipe and smoke that has some nice effects. And none of my friends were familiar with that, so they just thought it was just a foul-smelling pipe tobacco. But it didn't do. It didn't do what whiskey did. I did that for a while, but it nothing would replace the whiskey. And I was even so sensitive I could there was a different effect from the different drinks. You know, gin makes you feel one way, tequila makes you feel another way, and I was an expert at that kind of stuff. But I loved my whiskey. About 35 years ago, Christmas time, my friend, one of my best drinking buddies, asked me if I would go to his company Christmas party. He worked for some big electrical company or something. And he said, there's a little girl there, a secretary, that didn't have a date. Would I go and be her date? I never was really a social person. I didn't do a whole lot of dating, drunk or sober. And I didn't particularly want to go. I never had a blind date. Scared me to death. But he finally talked me into it. And so I got in touch with the little girl, went and picked her up, and we went to his Christmas party that night. I don't remember the date. It's not important. But we weren't at the party very long. I had a couple of drinks, and she said, you know, are you having fun? And I said, not particularly, no. This is not, you know, I'm not a party guy with crowds. She said, would you like to go somewhere and just talk? And I said, fine, you know. Of course, being the alcoholic I was, and she was a pretty nice-looking little blonde girl, and she invited me over to her house, and I'm thinking, well, you know, here we go, big boy, you know. The imperious urge had reappeared. So anyhow, we went to her house, and that's what we talked, I think, till about 3 o'clock in the morning. And somewhere along the line, it came out about my drinking. So I told her, you know, I've been trying to quit. I don't know what to do. I've been fighting it. I know I drink too much, but I can't not drink. And she said, well, if you're serious about doing it or you decide you really want to do it, I've got some friends that might be able to help. I said, well, if it gets to that point, I'll let you know. And anyhow, I went home and wasn't but a week or two later, one morning, a Sunday morning, I got up and hung over as usual and drinking Tanqueray gin. Only a drunk would remember that. And I felt horrible, but my daughter was getting baptized, and she asked me would I go to church with her. And I didn't normally go to church, but I said, surely. So I put on my coat and went. And I don't remember what happened. It wasn't anything profound. But when I got home, I was sitting in my living room contemplating a drink. There was a bottle in there. I had a cabinet where I kept my booze. And that moment of clarity that people talk about hit me. For some reason, out of the clear blue, I could see my life and where it was going. It was a downhill spiral. The pilots call it the death spiral when they get in the fog. I was just totally despondent. I didn't know what to do. For some reason, I don't really recall my thinking other than that I didn't like the way my life was headed. I went to the phone book and looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called them. And they said, we have a meeting Tuesday. Can you tell me where it was? Can you come to that? And I said, I believe I can. And I didn't drink. So Tuesday afternoon, I was getting ready to go, and the little girl that I had a date with called, and she said, I'm going to see my friends tonight. Would you like to go? And I said, well, I think we're probably going to the same place. I'll pick you up. And I did. It was my first AA meeting. It was actually December the 16th because I'd quit drinking a couple of days before, actually. And we went to the Club 12 there in Baton Rouge. The neat thing about this, there's two particular fields of women that I really love and appreciate. One of those is nurses because they saved my butt more than once. And this little girl was an Al-Anon. And she did the perfect Al-Anon 12-step on me. She didn't push it. She didn't do anything. She just asked questions and suggested. And that one more of the angels in my life, that unsolicited is the way I like to put it. You know, things happen unsolicited. It's not me. And they say that's God's way of being anonymous. And I agree with that. Anyhow, I went to the meeting and all the little cute sayings on the wall. Back then they smoked and the smoke would choke you to death. I don't remember. I met two guys, Lewis and Big Bob. I remember their names that I was introduced to. And after the meeting, we went to Shoney's and had the requisite ice cream and stuff. I met some interesting people there. I was much smarter and wiser than they were. But I put up with it. They said, make 90 meetings in 90 days. We'll refund you. Your misery if you don't like it. So I kind of made an internal thing. Well, I think I'm going to try 90 days. If I can stay sober 90 days, I can get healed up and I can go back to drinking. You know, little did I know you pick up where you left off. So I made an internal agreement. I'll stay sober for 90 days and we'll see what happens. During that 90 days, there was a couple of guys that came. I don't know, but when I sobered up, there was probably a half a dozen of us that came in around the same time. We kind of butted around and palled together with each other. A couple of those guys went out and back out and didn't make it back. And that kind of worried me. So I said, well, I better get serious about this. I got myself a sponsor. And in those days where I sobered up, sponsors did not take you through the big book and carry you through the steps. We went fishing a lot, he would every once in a while suggest that I might want to do the fourth step, and I always had an excuse I don't understand it, blah blah blah. He finally said, well, he said, did you think you might be afraid to do it? And I said, not true, but it was. And I don't know what this may have been. I may have been around a year. I don't really remember. But at some point, I got to a position. I remember when the term restless, irritable, and discontent. I was at home by myself, and I was pacing up down the hall, about to go crazy. And I went back in my bedroom and got on my knees, and by my bed, and I said, whatever it is out there, if it's God or whatever, can I please have some relief? I'm going to kill myself or die, whatever. I can't take this anymore. Bill calls it pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and it fits. But anyhow, I got on my knees and I asked God. I don't know that I said God. I may have, but something happened. I got a feeling. A chill went down my spine, and something happened. I don't know what it was, but I wasn't afraid anymore. My fear went away. I kind of suspected something bigger than me was going on. I finally got to the point where I figured, well, maybe I better start working these steps. and see what happens. I got ready to do the fourth step, and I got one night I got me a big yellow legal tablet and a ballpoint pen and put it on the coffee table, and sat down there, and I was just totally blank. What do you do? And of course the book tells you how to do it. I know now, but I didn't then, and nobody had explained it. I had all the little pamphlets and stuff, but they really wasn't much help. So I did the same thing. I went back and I got on my knees, and I said, God, I'm going to try to do this. If you'll give me what I'm supposed to do, I'm going to go sit down and take the pencil and paper and start writing. And I went in there and sat down, and I did my fourth step that night. I've heard it said that a fourth step, takes a year and a day, and that's about the case of mine. It doesn't necessarily have to drag out for 6 months to do a fourth step. And that carried me for a long time until I did it again. We moved from, let me backtrack a little bit. When I met my grand sponsor, and told him what my sobriety date, he made the comment. He said, "You sobered up back then where you people did 12-step calls to stay sober." And that's one thing I neglected to say is that even though I wasn't working the program, it was common. We always went in twos. And if somebody needed someone to go on a 12-step call, they'd call me. A rule that I've always followed in Alcoholics Anonymous from then until today, even when I didn't want to, is you don't say no. If it's humanly possible, you don't say no. And I didn't have an idea of what a 12-step was, but I went. And we used to, on weekends, the central office would transfer the phone to somebody's house. And on weekends, we'd kind of gather up at somebody's house and have coffee or barbecue, whatever else. And the phone would ring with a 12-step call. We'd pair up. We'd go take care of it. So anyhow, that's how I stayed sober the first quite a few months, I suppose, because I didn't do anything else. And I finally got around to working the steps, and we traveled around this group of us, ran around together. There was several ladies, girls, whatever, and several of us guys. And it was totally platonic. It was all a, we just did things together. We'd go to area assembly together, and we'd go, go do things, go out and eat together, things like that. And we all got pretty close. And about that time in our group, there was this tall, well-endowed blonde that was part of the group, and I was frankly terrified of her. My MO in my drinking was to find somebody that a girl or somebody's wife that appeared vulnerable and ease in for the kill, and usually we'd both had a few drinks, so that it was kind of like shooting fish in a barrel, and so I didn't know what to do with somebody that's clear-eyed and sane. It was just, what do you do? So anyhow, she was part of the group, and we all ran around and stuff. I guess the beginning of the episode was one night her son had broken his leg. He was in the Scouts. I went to a meeting at the Club 12, and I said, I asked her, where's Judy? And they said, she's at the hospital with her son. He broke his leg. And I said, well, who's with her? And they said, nobody. And I said, well, that's not right. Somebody ought to be there. And where that came from, I don't know, because I'm not particularly the type of person that helps other people. At least at that time, I wasn't. And so I went and bought some soda pops and some Fritos and cookies, and I went to the hospital, and she thought I was nuts. And I don't know why I did it. But anyhow, we sat there and talked, and it got to where, after the meetings, we were sitting down at her place or my place, just talking AA and sobriety and stuff, and a trust built up there between us. And finally the trust and the friends turned into love, and 31 years ago we got married. And it's been that was another one. One God sending an angel down, something unsolicited, because she didn't want to get married. And I didn't particularly want to get married. It was the furthest thing on my list of getting married. I had an abortive attempt to have a girlfriend for a while, and that didn't pan out real good. I'm not going into details on that. My experience wasn't too good. And I told, you know, it's important. I had talked to God again. We talked fairly regularly. I talked. And after this episode with the first girlfriend, I got on my knees and I told God, I said, look, if I'm supposed to live alone, that's good. I can deal with that, you know. If I'm supposed to have somebody, send somebody. But just save me from these stupid affairs and stuff like that. Because it's a pain in the butt. Dating is a pain in the butt. When you're 38 years old and you know, don't have a clue, it was something new. But anyhow, that's how she and I kind of got together and we got married and lived happily ever after. We were both involved in service work there in Louisiana at the state level. I think Judy was the secretary or something for a while, and I did something. I worked on the convention. We were very active service-wise, have been our whole lives. We moved to Houston and immediately got involved with service work in Houston and straightened them out at their district over there. They were doing some things that were incorrect, so we corrected them. I imagine they went back to what they were doing. We moved, I worked for the Enron Corp. You might have heard that name. I worked for one of the companies that was part of Enron. I got transferred from Houston to Winter Park, Florida, which is near Orlando. And we got stationed there and got involved in AA again. And went to the meetings and got involved in a little bit of service work. My job entailed working from around Miami, Fort Lauderdale to Corpus Christi, Texas. My department was the technical services. Excuse me, we were the troubleshooters. And so I'd use quite often get on an airplane Sunday night and fly out, and Friday night I would fly back in. And this went on. Every once in a while I'd have a couple of weeks at home. The thing of it is I got away from going to AA meetings. I didn't have a sponsor. I hadn't had a sponsor then until the first guy. When we moved away, I hadn't had a sponsor for several years. And I don't recommend that, by the way. When we hired young guys at work, I would tell them, you know, you guys are younger than me, you're smarter than me, you're better educated, but I've made all the mistakes. I can tell you what not to do. You know, you can read the book, know what to do. I can tell you what not to do. That's kind of the way I am with AA. I don't encourage anybody to do it the way I did it. I think probably the purpose of my talk is to let people know that the path is wider than you might imagine. And if you just halfway want to stay sober, you can do it, because I did. But I quit going to meetings, and I was traveling, and Judy would usually stick that little 24-hour book in my suitcase, or maybe a big book. And I never forgot that I was an alcoholic. Although I wasn't going to meetings, at first I tried to go to some meetings, and it just got to be impossible. When we were out of town, we would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and hit the plant and work till about dark, come home, eat supper, the motel, eat supper, and go to bed. So it had been difficult. The saving grace was the people I was working with didn't drink. So, you know, it kind of gave me a breather. In 1999, I encountered another angel. It was a Sunday morning, and I got up not feeling real good. I had what felt like a sore throat. I had a pain up here in my upper chest or lower neck, whatever you want to call it. And I figured it might have been my esophagus. I might have had something, esophagitis or whatever you want to call it. And it didn't hurt that bad, but it was uncomfortable. And I'd had it, you know, occasionally it would come and go, but this time it wouldn't go away. So Judy called the next door neighbor, who was a nurse, and she came over and she gave me some antacids and stuff, and it didn't go away. So she said, why don't you go to the emergency room? If you're not sick, they'll send you home. If they are, you know, they'll fix you up. So we got in the car and drove. She dropped me off at the emergency room door, and I walked on in and said, you know, I'm having some pains in my upper chest. They put me on a little gurney or dolly, whatever it is, and rolled me back behind the curtains. About 10 minutes later, my light started going out, I told Judy, I said, there's something wrong. You know, I'm fixing to go out. And they swarmed it, and there happened to be an excellent cardiologist there. I was in the middle of a pretty dandy heart attack. Afterwards, the doctor told me, he said, if y'all hadn't come in when you did, you wouldn't be alive. He said, if that had happened at home, you couldn't have gotten here in time. So that's why I can say that. And I sent the girl here a while back another letter thanking her, calling her my special angel. She saved my life. If she hadn't pushed it, I'd have stuck around the house. So anyhow, I had a heart attack. They did a triple bypass, and I was in and out of the hospitals. I've got a defibrillator pacemaker, Jobby, and they couldn't get it adjusted, and I kept having my heart running wild, and crazy things happening. And I encountered another angel. I was in the hospital with one of these trips. I was always in cardiac ICU, which is a lovely place to be. You hear all these machines going beep, 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 and there's a big clock at the end. So you're laying there, you're looking at the clock. And one night I was in there, and there was a little nurse that, for some reason, I don't know why, I didn't think she was particularly competent. I don't know why, just being judgmental. And I told Judy when she left to go home that evening, I said, I'm going to have to watch this girl. I don't think she knows what she's doing. And so Judy left, and I'm laying there. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm watching that clock go around. And I'm absolutely terrified, just a total panic attack, stark raving terror. I was about to come unwrapped. I didn't know what to do, you know, and I couldn't go. I was all strapped in, had a thing. I couldn't go anywhere. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, when I was doing this, I didn't say a word to anybody. This little nurse came in, and she walked around the side of my bed, and she said, Mr. Conrad, would you mind if I prayed for you? And she did. And it was like she gave me a shot of Novocaine. It was, you know, she said, God, relieve his pain and give him some peace. And it did. And it was just another miracle, another angel in my life to reinforce my idea of this program that there's something bigger than us running things. I choose to call it God. Anyhow, we came home and we moved to Alabama. We had bought a place as a property and commenced to build a house. I still wasn't going to meetings. And some friends of ours from Louisiana suggested that they'd like to come see us, stay with us over a weekend and go to a convention there in Gulf Shores. They call it the Jubilee Convention. And I had never heard of it. They said, y'all don't have to go. You know, we just look for everyone. We'll stay there. We're good friends. And so, sure, y'all come on over. So they did, and I said, well, you know, I hadn't been to anything like this. Maybe I ought to go. So we got dressed, and we went. And sometimes during the convention, standing out in the hall like and talking like we do, this guy came up to me. He heard us talking. He said, are you from Louisiana? And I said, well, that's where I sobered up. He said, where do you go to meetings? And I said, well, I really hadn't been to any. I don't know. I don't know where they are. I told him where I lived. He said, well, not too far from you is a little group. The Blue Book group, which is a big book study group, he said, why don't you come see us Monday night at 8 o'clock? So I said, well, I might do that. Some period later, I don't know, a week or two, whatever, Judy and I decided, well, let's go to a meeting. Or she probably decided, and I went along with she's much smarter than I am about those sort of things. But anyhow, we went to this meeting, and it was a nice little small meeting, and Magnolia Springs is a little small community and really nice people. So we started going regularly, joined still my home group today. And after a little bit, I got to asking, trying to find this guy that had recommended that I go to it. So I talked to some of the people that had been there for quite a while, and I described him and told him, you know, he's tall, you know, and he's got a little bit of an accent and stuff, and nobody had a clue who he was. And I've not seen him since. I don't know that I would recognize him today, but, you know, where he come from, I don't know, you know, but I don't question it. I don't question it. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I was involved in the service work at the district and the state for a long time, and finally the young people, it was time for me to rotate out and let some of the young people have it, which I did. We live a peaceful life today. Our kids, she has 3 sons, I had 4 daughters. And if you saw them together, you would think they were really brothers and sisters. The family merged beautifully. It's been a good life. We live out in the country. We've got some acreage and a nice house, and a couple of times a year we would throw these get-togethers and have people come over, and we'd barbecue and stuff, and we'd do it New Year's and Labor Day. New Year's, Judy'd make about 10 gallons of gumbo, and people would come over and, you know, bring a covered dish, and we've had as many as 200 people show up to it, our health got kind of bad here a couple years ago. We quit doing it, but I think we're going to pick it up again New Year's. I hadn't even looked at my watch. I don't have any idea. That's making a hell of a lot of difference. When I get through, I'm going to shut up. That's a mistake a lot of people make. I'm not taking anybody's inventory, but I tell the people I sponsor or anybody that's getting ready to talk, you know, when you get to the end of your story, say thank you and sit down and shut up. You know, I don't know that there's any rule you've got to fill in a whole hour's worth of talking. I probably could, but it wouldn't be that fun. And I forgot where I was going with that, anyhow. but both of us sponsor people today. Our life is good as you could want. We've had our ups and downs in 30 years, and I would probably honestly say, and she would agree, that if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, we wouldn't be married. You know, we made some sort of unwritten pact right when we got married that divorce was not an option, and that means we had to slug it out and figure out what it's going to take to stay together. And there's been times where it's been awful rough. You take two type A alcoholics that have been single for a few years and put them together, you know, when I want to go fishing, I don't need anybody's damn permission. The problem is, she likes to fish more than I do. The plus side of that is, we were shopping for boats. We had a boat that was getting kind of old, so we were shopping for boats, and we went to the boat store, and it was looking. It was a nice, I think, 18 or 19 footer that I was looking at. And well, they didn't have one. They had a bigger one, but it was physically like the one I was looking at in a different town. And she got in the thing, looked at it, she says, "This is the one we want." So we got a bigger boat than I would have wanted. Although it's worked out real well. And we fish as much as we can. I don't have too many words of wisdom. Everything I know, pretty much I've learned from everybody else. I have my watchword around Alabama where I am is pay attention. I stress that, pay attention. My home group used to pass the basket during the middle of the meeting when people were talking. That really teed me off, you know. And my feeling, this is just a personal thing, it's not a rule. My feeling is that the last person talking is just as important as the first one talking. And if that basket goes around, people are digging in their wallet and we're not paying attention to what they're saying. Or if it's the middle of the meeting, whatever, it doesn't make any difference. To me, it's a distraction. My problem is I'm easily distracted. You know, if somebody was in the back of the thing talking back there, I'd have to quit, and you know, I get sidetracked very easily. So we made it in our group. We do all the stuff, and we pass the basket before the meeting starts, or right after it starts, before we get into it. That's just one of my pet peeves, I suppose. And I also believe, and I've seen it happen, that if I pay attention to the people in the meeting and watch what they're saying and watch their body language, I might be able to help somebody that doesn't know they need help. It's quite often said, you know, the suffering alcoholic might be the guy that's been sober 10 years sitting next to you. And that's true. You know, in my 30-some-odd years, there have been times where I just got mentally screwed up, bad, whatever. You know, but the strange thing is, as long as I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, when I'm in that kind of place, the phone will ring and somebody will call out of the clear blue and say, "How you doing, Wayne?" And we'll get to chat. And in a few minutes, I'm out of myself. You know, I'm out of that hole. And so I tried to do the same thing. There was a guy caught me. He had just moved to town a few years ago. And I ran into him somewhere. And he says, "How you doing?" I said, I'm doing all right. Why do you ask? He said, well, he said, I was taught where I sobered up, you always ask the old folks how they're doing because some of them might have problems and you might not know it. You know, sometimes it's hard for older people in the program to admit they have a problem. Not for me. It's not for me. The only thing that I attribute to long-term sobriety, if what I have is long-term, is the fact that I've discovered that the longer that I practice these principles, the more of my personality they become. The big book says that we're going to have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And the way I change that, my personality, is doing what it says in the big book. And my experience is the more I do that, the easier life becomes. I don't have to think twice before I spout off and curse somebody out or hit them in the mouth. Just not a big deal. It's extremely difficult to make me upset. And the book says, I think it's both in the big book and the 12 by 12, you know, if I'm upset, there's something wrong with me. You know, and if you come at me, there's probably something wrong with you, and I need to see what I can do for you rather than get mad at you. And I practice that. And it's become easier and easier as time goes on. So I would say pay attention. If you're new to the program, which is not many people here are new, but if you're new to the program, don't leave before the miracle happens. And if you've been here a while, don't leave after it happens. Thank you.